The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to be exploring why sugar should be regulated like a controlled substance. Why some folks are saying yes. Ari Laveau from Alternet. The latest on what will prevent colorectal cancer in our health and nutrition segment, which will come following our guest, and how to decrease all diseases. Yeah, there is something that seems to work for everyone. Commentaries today from Harvey Wasserman, we may yet lose Tokyo, not to mention Alaska, and now Georgia too. As the Nuclear Regulatory Commission approves the construction and operating license for two new reactors in Georgia, alarming reports from Japan indicate the Fukushima catastrophe, it's still going on. And we'll tell you about it. From Mike Bundrant, five lies personal growth gurus love to tell you, like you can have anything you want and change is easy and mastery comes quickly, and the mind can be programmed to succeed, and all you need to do is, well, we're going to share that with you as well. Also, President Obama retreats on birth control mandate, but a very interesting piece of legislation from State Senator Constance Johnson, Oklahoma, who I'm going to wait to tell you because you won't believe what this is about. Also, a scorecard is just in that shows from the National Environmental Group that right now we have the most anti-environmental group in the history of Congress, both in the House and the Senate. Never been worse for the environment, never been better for corporate America. And also today, a talk back from Steve Brown, one of the listeners, why Obama is a sellout. And I'll explain this on this giving the banks a get out of jail free. They give us $20 billion. Oh, and did anyone mention what is the high likelihood that they'll go to the Federal Reserve and borrow from us at zero interest the money to pay back that $20 billion and the millions of crimes they committed, the illegal acts, clear, gone, wiped away. So how do we gain? We don't. How do they gain? Tremendously. What do we lose? A commentary on that. Also, if he was still around talking on Fox Network, Judge Napolitano might have something to say about new information. The FAA is now allowing 30,000 domestic drones to fill our skies. There are some voices within the civil libertarians movement, including New York civil libertary groups, that are saying we shouldn't allow this. But for the mainstream media, left and right, not a word. So I'm going to play a couple tapes, including one with Ralph Nader, about what should we do for all those who've lied to us, committed crimes against humanity, caused an enormous amount of suffering. Should we do what Obama suggested, give him a pass, look forward. Well, some believe we should. But those of us who believe no, if you commit a crime against humanity, then you should be held accountable. we'll tell you what Ralph Nader has to say. So as you see, we have a packed hour. But in honoring a Black Education Day today, we are starting our program for one of our New York City stations, WBAI, by inviting Glenn Ford, executive editor of the Black Agenda Report and son of a famed disc jockey, who was the first Black television host to have a non-gospel radio show in the Deep South. In the 1970s, my guest, Glenn, was also a correspondent and journalist covering Capitol Hill and the White House for the Mutual Black Network. He later hosted the nation's first syndicated Black news interview program, America's Black Forum. And since then, he's been one of the nation's leading voices in political and social analysis and commentary on current affairs in the Black community. He is also a founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists. Nice to have you with us today, Glenn.
Thanks for the invitation, Gary.
Glenn is also has a very popular radio program, the Black Agenda Report, heard every Monday at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Glenn, as you know, this past Monday on the Progressive Commentary Hour, Monday at 7 p.m., we had a topic on the problems with our war on drugs. And I held one part of that really off the table substantially, so you could address it today, if you would, please. And that is, I'm going to throw several issues at you. Take them in any order you want and address them, all right? Now,
okay.
The issues are that today more African Americans are incarcerated in our prisons than were the slaves in 1850, meaning there were more people in prison today than there were slaves in the United States. Also, if we were to return to 1970 prison population levels before the war on drugs, more than a million people in the prison system would have their jobs disappear. And of all African American men born before 1965 with less than a high school diploma, 60% have a prison record. The new Jim Crow. Define what this means for those who are not familiar with this expression. Then how is incarceration being used as a form of disenfranchisement? And finally, does a system where African Americans being targeted for arrest through discriminatory police practices and their labor once in prison used to enrich private moneyed interests sound like a phenomena of the 21st century? Or to me, that sounds like a phenomenon of the 18th and 19th century. So how does this psychology work for utilizing the prison system as a means for aggressive social control? The forum is yours.
Well, I'm glad that you put it in a historical perspective. What we've been saying at Black Agenda Report for years is that mass black incarceration is the general society, and I mean the white society's response to the mass movement of the 1960s, just as mass black incarceration was the response to emancipation in the Deep South, when black folks were essentially, black males, dragooned off the streets and put in plantations that masqueraded as prison farms to have their labor extracted for free. Also, these were not just prison farms. People were put in prisons that were basically mining operations, all manner of forced labor, an attempt to reimpose the old social order. Michelle Alexander, in her book, The New Jim Crow, puts it in that kind of context as well, that the mass black incarceration phenomenon, which becomes evidence around 1970, is a response to the movement of the 1960s. It is as if the response to that movement was, okay, you black folks don't want to stay in your place, the place that we have designated for you at the bottom of society. Well, we have a new place for you, and that's the prison. And so we've seen the general prison population increase from 1970, when it was 300,000 or so, to about 2.4 million. That's an 8 times increased, but the proportion of black people in prison has increased as well. In the mid-60s, the U.S. prison and jail population was about 70% black. Today, the ratio is opposite. It's about 30%. It was 70% white in the mid-60s. Now it's about 30% white and about 70% non-white. Worldwide, one out of every eight prison inmates on the planet is an African American. You know, I remember when the book by Solzhenitsyn, The Gulag Archipelago, came out, and it generated a great deal of publicity, and everyone was talking about how Russia was such a deformed police state in which the prison system was an integral part of the state. But the United States has vastly surpassed anything that the Soviet Union represented in terms of being an incarceration state, and it's all about race. So we can't talk about the war on drugs without talking about mass black incarceration. Since the 1970s, black activists have been proclaiming that the war on drugs is nothing but a war on black folks. And it's not just the raw data in terms of the ridiculous number of black people who've been put in jail on drug charges. 90% of federal inmates serving time for drugs are black. But it's more than just those raw numbers, because the war on drugs has been used as an excuse to vastly increase the hyper-surveillance of black communities. And mass incarceration begins with hyper-surveillance. If you are looking for crime, you will find it or you will invent it. And so when the black community is put under a microscope, when it is blanketed with a police presence, what will inevitably result will be increased arrests, increased convictions, and ultimately an entire society, an entire community that is treated as if they are, if not criminals, potential criminals, criminals in waiting. What Michelle Alexander basically is saying is that crime has been racialized in the American in the American perspective, that crime and black folks are inextricably intertwined, and that all black folks are now at this stage of the game suspects and treated as such.
I appreciate your opening comments. Can you comment on this idea that our entire legal system, from the courts to incarceration to parole and probation, essentially turn a person who commits a crime into a moron cultural outcast who is not worthy of rehabilitation but is best exiled permanently from society, meaning they're re-ghettoized? Now, I'm asking you to compare that with what I consider paradox. I have some new films coming out, and I have some new investigative reports coming out. In my investigative report, which will be next week, I simply looked at the pharmaceutical industry, and I looked at Wall Street banks, just those two. And I didn't even look at all of them. I looked at the top 20 Wall Street firms and the top 20 pharmaceutical industry giants. So we're really talking about 40 corporations in all the world. And I found that without exception, not a single exception, every one of the top Wall Street firms and every one of the top pharmaceutical companies had repeatedly been found guilty and had large settlements of violating the law. And frequently, in the case of pharmaceutical companies, that meant that they produced drugs knowingly, putting drugs into the marketplace that were defective, dangerous. And when we looked at the actual legal documents, and when we spoke, and I went to Washington, D.C. last week, I filmed several lawyers there. In fact, all told, I think we filmed 15 different law firms and lawyers. And when they show you the documents obtained from the discovery that scientists working within the companies knew they had bad drugs, the board of directors knew they had bad drugs, the managers, the president, the marketing director, everyone knew this was a bad drug. And then they went on to put that in the marketplace, and you say, well, why would they do that? A, because they knew that being a major corporation, their reputation as a corporation, no matter how many times they were found guilty, and by the way, in one case, over 200,000 lawsuits were settled, but they put it into the cost of doing business. Now, I'm making a little extensive overview for you so that you see the connection. So anyhow, what happens is that the drugs, including Vioxx, that one alone killed 60,000 people, injured 100 to 150,000 with heart attack and stroke. They knew in advance it was a bad drug. They knew it would do this. And only one whistleblowing courageous doctor, Dr. Graham at the FDA, who sent up a warning, immediately he was harassed and intimidated and threatened inside the FDA by FDA officials. The bottom line to this was, no one's reputation was hurt. No one went to jail. No one personally was vilified. The stock value went up in the company. The president of the company got a raise. And that was one example of over, are you ready for this? Nearly $1 trillion almost paid out by Wall Street firms and pharmaceutical companies where they injured people, lied, deceived, manipulated. And because no one was personally held accountable, not a single person in the pharmaceutical industry, not one. When Hoffman Roach was found guilty of price-fixing vitamin C, $700 million fine, and that was it. Everyone's reputation was fine. So on the one hand, we have this standard that as long as you are profitable, you are an officially recognized and accepted corporation, you give large political donations to Democrats and Republicans alike, you have former members of the president's personal staffs and advisors who are on your boards or sit as advisors, you are virtually incapable of being found guilty of anything, including former presidents and vice presidents and secretaries of state, secretaries of defense who lied, committed perjury, and are now are being given a clean bill of health. Now compare that with a man of color who gets arrested with an ounce of marijuana in Harlem. And what happens to that man in their reputation and what society deems is their value to society and wanting to permanently exile them, not to see them, not to want to know they exist. And yet, on the other hand, are completely open-armed, open-heart, open-minded in the media and everywhere else about the next thing this purse company brings out. We're going to love it. We're going to embrace it. That's 900,000 doctors, the thousands of hospitals, the members of Congress and the American media are going to play their ads on television as if these people are not serial offenders and murdering thousands upon tens of thousands of people. To me, I think this is a national disgrace. I'm embarrassed by this, that no one has called them out on it. I'd like for you to see your for you to give us your assessment of this, please.
Well, what you've just described is a vast criminal conspiracy. You've described criminal enterprises. These are the kinds of enterprises that the RICO criminal conspiracy statutes should have been written to control. But in fact, what we have actually seen is that the RICO statutes, those statutes that broke new ground in law in terms of defining and prosecuting criminal conspiracies, instead of being used to prosecute these mega offenders that you just described, they're being used to prosecute young people, young black and Latino men primarily, for supposedly being gang affiliated. And so the law has been contorted and distorted to apply mostly in terms of so-called gang control. So not only are people prosecuted not for specific crimes, they're prosecuted for having tattoos that supposedly designate them as part of a gang that is then called a criminal enterprise, or for throwing up hand signals that connect them to these so-called criminal enterprises or gangs, which may be just youth affinity groups in a neighborhood. So this is the phenomenon that we're witnessing, where the American criminal justice juggernaut, which has all the tools that it needs and then some in terms of comparisons with the law in much of the rest of the Western world, is directed not to the mega offenders who, as you said, kill tens of thousands, but to young juveniles of color on the street.
My last question for you. By the way, there are gangs, and these gangs can be vicious and kill people and rape and should be dealt with. But the way you ultimately deal with gangs is that you go into their environment and ask, why does this gang exist? What motivates a person to join a gang? Is there any other alternative that could be a deterrent to that? Can we de-ghettoize these environments to give opportunities to give a person a chance to live a life with some sense, semblance of fairness that would prevent them from reaching out to a gang? And I believe that we have not addressed that honestly and openly, nor have we gone in where I have, Camden, New Jersey, and other places, and spent time and go house to house, door to door, as I did, as you'll see in this new film, and just talk with people. And by the way, it was interesting because when I was in the middle of the street in Camden, this white car pulls up, and this a woman says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm filming." "Why are you here?" I said, "Because I'm here to film people who are poor." "Well, you're going to get yourself killed." I said, "No, I'm not." I said, "Poor people don't go out and kill people." I says, "If you've got a problem with gangs, and you've got a problem," and I knew she was a cop. I said, "If you've got a problem with gangs, you've got a problem with people, do you have a problem with poor? Do you have a problem with disenfranchised? Do you have a problem with segregated? Do you have a problem with overlooked? Do you have a problem with any of this?" I said, "Because this used to be a prosperous area. When there was industry here, before these jobs were outsourced to other countries, this was the second largest shipbuilding center in America, where there was no ghetto, there was no crime, there was no 200 open air street place to get drugs." I said, "You think people get drugs because they want a better life, or do they want drugs because it's one way of escaping the pain that they're in?" I said, "I'm looking at a different point of view here. You're looking at the person that's going out to go out there and take advantage of a situation. And who are they taking advantage of? Their own neighbors." I said, "I'm here to get their story, a story that's not being told anywhere in the United States. We're afraid of this. It's something we don't want to remind ourselves of, because then we have to remind ourselves, did we have anything to do this, and can we change it?" And so I asked this undercover police officer, I said, "Look," I said, "do you know that for the cost of a carrier that we don't need, to be going out to threaten China, that we are stupid to do since we borrow money from them," I said, "we could rebuild all of Camden. You could have a housing center, youth centers, cultural centers. You could have workshops. You could have tutoring. You could have holistic assisted living centers. You could have inner school systems. You could do everything necessary to rehabilitate this morally, spiritually, and physically." And the person said, "I don't know any about that. All I know about is you're going to get yourself hurt." I says, "I'm not going to get hurt." And I didn't. And not because I had an arm or a posse. No, I had none of that. And when I went door to door to talk with the people in Camden, New Jersey, they all told me the same thing. I mean, I went into a house where a woman had no electricity, where there was no water, but there was not enough money in the town to provide even the repair that was due her. She'd been on a repair list for several years. So one air carrier could completely change Camden, arguably one of the poorest cities in all of America, per size, even poorer than Detroit, and that's hard to imagine. So my question is this. How does this trend diminish the advances of the civil rights movement, and does this trend contribute to the new rhetoric with the white-dominated political right calling for new modes of racial segregation? Your thoughts for the final question of our interview.
Well, you were speaking of how relatively small amounts of money compared to our war budgets could rehabilitate and make livable places like Camden. And, of course, all that is true. But the actual model for rehabilitation of neighborhoods in the United States is gentrification. And so if Camden's going to get an influx of money, and I'm just using Camden as a model, the most likely way that would happen would be to disperse the people of Camden, who are overwhelmingly black and brown. That's what's occurring all over the country, that rather than rehabilitate, remodel, reinvigorate urban centers for the benefit of the people who live there, the thrust, and this is the thrust of developers, of banks, of people who do accumulate capital to change urban areas, the thrust is to disperse the poor to who knows where, to smaller Camdens or somewhere down south, but never to make the city more livable for the people who actually live there. And as long as those populations are black and brown, the social response is to increase levels of police surveillance, often under the excuse that this is designed to protect the residents of the cities. The effect is exactly the opposite. It incarcerates the young people of those cities who inevitably come back and create a youth culture that is thoroughly saturated with the culture of the prisons and of course becomes a much more dangerous one, which is then responded to with even more police surveillance, with stop and frisk policies that have become general in the United States that only succeed in incarcerating more young black and brown men. It's a cycle that is based on the original response, which was not to accommodate the folks who had fought for a new levels of freedom in the 1960s, but to somehow contain them and to contain them institutionally, which means prisons.
It's also a form of inverted globalization. We now know, in fact, I broke it as an exclusive story this week, that 8.4 million American jobs from educated individuals with college degrees, frequently in engineering, and frequently in the Silicon Valley, were taken over by those brought in on visas from India, college educated, very intelligent, and in a very, almost a macabre way. And this started under Clinton when he wanted the financial support of Silicon Valley billionaires, and he got it. But in return, they've got this unlimited amounts of these special forms of visas that bring the people in. We're not talking about people coming across, illegal immigrants across the border to work in bean fields or anything they can do. We're talking about highly educated people who come in, and then the American employee has to teach these individuals their job, generally over a six-month period. Then the American employee is fired, and the highly educated visa person gets to take that job at anywhere from 30 to 50% less salary, no benefits, which they're happy to do because it's better than what they would have in their country, generally in India this case. But who knew that 8.4 million American jobs were not outsourced, they were insourced? And who knew that 54,000 factories had been closed down under both Democrat and Republican administrations since 2000? Who knew that? 54,000 factories? And where do you think those factories were? And what do you think happens to the neighborhoods in theirs? See, I don't look at this exclusively as a black and white issue. I look at this as power. And I can show you communities that are predominantly white and poor and are treated just as with so much disdain. I just finished filming all across America, so I've been there, town after town. I can take you down to Louisiana. I can take you down to Mississippi. I can take you over to West Virginia. I can take you into Appalachia. I can take you down in the backwoods of Kentucky. I can show you people who are poor, whether white or of any other color. If they don't have power and they don't have money, then they are all treated with the same disdain. And then you look at the corporatizing, the privatizing, the globalization, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, GATT, the politicians, the banks, the Wall Street firms, the vultures who prey, predatory capitalism. That's what I call it, predatory capitalism. There is also conscious capitalism. where you're absolutely encouraged to make a living, do what you can, but make sure that the world and people are better off because of it. We're a better group, we're a better community, and where you include not just profits for yourself, but you look at how you can take profits, and instead of giving it all to the shareholders to brag to Wall Street, invest in us, look at how we've downsized, look at how we've brought in new workers to take the place of ones that we could save money on. Instead, you actually increase the wages so that you have more money, disposable income, living wage for people to be able to benefit. You give proper maternity leave. You make sure that mothers and their developing babies and children have time together so that that bond is crucial, because that's the citizen of tomorrow. You watch any child that grows up without a mother being with them as they should be. You're watching a problem evolve, and we're not even willing to take the time to look at it. Profits above everything else. So Glenn Ford, as always, thank you very much for being with us. People can listen to Glenn's program, very important program, by the way, a very popular program, Mondays, 4 p.m., Black Agenda Report on Progressive Radio Network. Thank you very much, Glenn.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. Here is our issue of the day, and then I'm going to ask you to call in on it. We've got a couple. First, this is from Steve Brown, one of our listeners, and he says the following. Now, this is involving the $25 billion bank get out of jail free. A group of banks give anywhere from a few hundred million dollars or higher to the federal government and disperses it. And the most you could get, if let's say you had a $400,000 home and you lost it, you're going to get $2,000 if you're lucky. $2,000. So the banks are happy as can be. They can't be sued. Everything is washed clean. And all those banks hired more lobbyists to give more money to the president and all members of Congress that they could than any other lobbying group. So this money won't even have to come from them. It can come from the Federal Reserve, that they borrow it as they did $16 trillion. So here's what Steve Brown says, quote, "What a sellout the president did. I knew New York and California would cave in, but what is most disgusting is the New York Times' deliberately misleading spin on the settlement, which paints it as a win for the public instead of a win for the banks. The settlement sum is trivial for the banks, helps very few, and lets the banks off without admission of guilt or fear of future or further criminal or civil prosecution. Go Obama." That's from Steve Brown. What are your thoughts about giving a bank a get out of free? And also, what about this? How about the administration let everyone who's ever committed any crime, from the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, no prosecution, no matter what they did, torture, starting wars that they knew were false, nothing. Now, to give you a little background on this, here's what two individuals have to say about it, Judge Napolitano and Ralph Nader.
The more serious violations of habeas corpus. You know, after 9/11, Bush rounded up thousands of Americans, many of them Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, and they were thrown in jail without charges. They didn't have lawyers. Some of them were pretty mistreated in New York City. They were all released eventually.
Correct.
What is that what you mean also about throwing people in jail without charges, violating habeas corpus?
That is so obviously a violation of the natural law, the natural right to be brought before a neutral arbiter within moments of the government taking your freedom away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And the Constitution itself, as the Supreme Court in the Boumediene case pretty much said, wherever the government goes, the Constitution goes with it, and wherever the Constitution goes are the rights that the Constitution has to guarantee, and habeas corpus cannot be suspended by the president ever. It can only be suspended by the Congress in times of rebellion, which In re Milligan says, being rebellion of such magnitude that judges can't get into their courthouses. That has not happened in American history. So what President Bush did with the suspension of habeas corpus, with the whole concept of Guantanamo Bay, with the whole idea that he could avoid and evade federal laws, treaties, federal judges, and the Constitution, was blatantly unconstitutional and in some cases criminal.
What's the sanction? for President Bush.
Fortunately, there has been no sanction except what history will say about them.
What should be the sanction?
They should have been indicted. They absolutely should have been indicted for torturing, for spying, for arresting without warrant. I'd like to say they should be indicted for lying, but believe it or not, unless you're under oath, lying is not a crime. Yeah. At least not an indictable crime. It's a moral crime.
So you think George W. Bush and Dick Cheney should, even though they've left office, they haven't escaped the criminal laws, they should be indicted and prosecuted?
The evidence in this book and in others, our colleague, the great Vincent Bugliosi, has amassed an incredible amount of evidence. The purpose of this book was not to amass that evidence, but I do discuss it. Is overwhelming when you compare it to the level of evidence required for a normal indictment, that George W. Bush as president and Dick Cheney as vice president participated in criminal conspiracies to violate the federal law and the guaranteed civil liberties of hundreds, maybe thousands of human beings.
The other day I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal about whether or not the Congress could, under the Constitution, regulate health care. Obviously, it can't. Health care is not mentioned in the Constitution. The framers had doctors. The framers had hospitals. The framers got sick. The framers needed health care. It was beyond their wildest imaginings that they would be creating a government that would somehow be able to regulate this kind of human behavior. But they did give the Congress a very unique power called the power to regulate interstate commerce. Madison argued that to regulate means, and this is what it meant at the time, if you have an Oxford English Dictionary, which gives you the history of the meaning of words throughout history, to regulate meant to keep regular. It meant to make sure that there is commerce between the states. Not to allow the Congress to regulate everything under the sun, but just to make sure that interstate commerce is regular. To prevent, for example, the state of Pennsylvania from saying to merchants in New Jersey, you can't sell your goods here, only local merchants in Pennsylvania can sell them. That's what the Commerce Clause was written for. But Congress, of course, has used it to regulate the air that you breathe and the water that you drink and the force of the shower in your home and the size of your toilet bowl and the number of legs on your desk chair and on and on and on. Do you know that the Congress has used the Interstate Commerce Clause to make it a crime for you to speak the truth? If an FBI agent shows up at your house with a self-written search warrant, the agent will tell you, you may not tell anyone about this. You may not tell your spouse in the bedroom. You may not tell a priest in the confessional. You may not tell your lawyer in her or his office. You may not tell anyone in whom you confide. You can't even answer truthfully in a courtroom under oath whether or not you received one of these warrants without violating the Patriot Act. Well, in Bridgeport, Connecticut, two FBI agents showed up and delivered one of these handwritten search warrants to an 86-year-old librarian. She looked at them and said, "Who the hell are you and what the hell is this?" And she handed it to her 76-year-old assistant, whereupon they were arrested because she revealed to another human being that the FBI had come calling. They were indicted and they were tried. And your federal government attempted to put an 86-year-old librarian and her 76-year-old assistant in a federal prison for 5 years because they told people that federal agents came calling with a self-written search warrant.
That's Judge Napolitano. Also, who's talking in the media about the 30,000 domestic drones that are in the skies? And I have some new information that I'll be giving next week about these drones are now being equipped with special ID recognition where they can look at your face or have a picture of your face if they're looking for you and actually track you. Oh, yeah. Who gave them this right? It's under the Patriot Act. Now, separately, President Obama retreats on birth control mandate. This is from The Hill. Quote, the White House has announced a retreat from its controversial rule requiring a religious organization like charities and hospitals to include contraception in their health care plans. He came under heavy criticism of the Catholic Church. Now, I saw the House leader, Boehner, talking about how this was terrible, you know, that there shouldn't have to be any mandate on contraception. I just have a question. Isn't it also true the studies show that 98% of Catholic women have used contraception? And what does it mean if young people are engaged in sexual activity? Would that not prevent unwanted pregnancies? Would it not prevent sexually transmitted diseases? And how do you deal with that? But no one was willing to deal with it, except someone you're going to hear in a moment. This is kind of a counterbalance to House Speaker Boehner. But there's a senator, State Senator Constance Johnson of Oklahoma, who thought very strongly about this and said, yeah, you know, we have to enact legislation that really protects anything that's unborn or that promotes it as personhood. So there's a movement to promote personhood as early as not when the baby is born, but when it actually begins as sperm. So in this bill, quote, the bill sought to define human life as beginning at the moment of conception before it's even implanted in the womb and offers full legal protection to those tiny molecules. In the words of the bill, quote, the unborn child at every stage of development has all the rights, privileges, and immunities available to other persons, citizens, and residents of the state. Now, however, what it means is any action which a man ejaculates or otherwise deposits semen anywhere but in a woman's vagina shall be interpreted and construed as an action against an unborn child. Among other things, the amendment would essentially outlaw oral sex, anal sex, and masturbation. Because, of course, if you masturbated, and where the sperm going to go, the sperm are going to die, in which case then that is an act against an unborn child. Well, that's just another argument that's being put out there. Wow, wow, wow. Where do these people think of all this stuff? So just remember, all you Catholics, if you masturbate, you're sinning, and it could be illegal. Wow. Here's someone who has a response for President Obama. President Obama, this is for you.
Boy, these conservatives are really something, aren't they? They're all in favor of the unborn. They will do anything for the unborn. But once you're born, you're on your own. Pro-life conservatives are obsessed with the fetus from conception to 9 months. After that, they don't want to know about you. They don't want to hear from you. No, nothing. No neonatal care, no daycare, no Head Start, no school lunch, no food stamps, no welfare, no nothing. If you're pre-born, you're fine. If you're preschool, you're conservatives don't give a about you until you reach military age. Then they think you are just fine, just what they've been looking for. Conservatives want live babies so they can raise them to be dead soldiers. Pro-life. Pro-life. These people aren't pro-life, they're killing doctors. What kind of pro-life is that? What, they'll do anything they can to save a fetus, but if it grows up to be a doctor, they just might have to kill it? They're not pro-life. You know what they are? They're anti-woman. Simple as it gets. Anti-woman. They don't like it. They don't like women.
Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. Now we're going to reverse our program and go to the health and nutrition segment. I will take some calls as they come in on these issues. But now health is our agenda. Black raspberries prevent colorectal cancer. This is from Cancer Prevention, a peer-reviewed journal done at Ohio State University. Now, all of us know about red raspberries, but a lot of people don't know about black raspberries. They kind of taste the same, except they're black. And they contain natural compounds that significantly reduce the risk of colorectal cancer. So, good news. Eat black raspberries. Very important for you. So, and I would suggest throw them in a blender or a juice. Now, what can help virtually decrease all major diseases? According to the International Journal of Food Safety and Nutrition and Public Health, fiber. This is from Science Daily. Here's what it says. Quote, we should all be eating more dietary fiber to improve our health. That's the message from a health review by scientists. The team has looked at research conducted into dietary fiber during the last half decade across the globe and now suggests that it is avoiding the problem by meaning diseases of all types by simply having higher fiber. Some people call it roughage. But in general, it's just the non-digestible parts of the fruit and vegetables that we eat. Now, there are two types of fiber. There's soluble and insoluble. Soluble fiber, which is your prebiotic, fiber is readily broken down or fermented in the colon into a physiologically active byproduct and gases. The second form is insoluble fiber, which is metabolically inert, but absorbs water as it passes through the digestive tract, and that provides the bulk of the intestinal muscles' movement, and that's what makes it easier to defecate. So we should be having more fruits like berries, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries. All of that is important. And also fibers from whole grains and beans and nuts and seeds. You put all that together, about 50 grams a day, and you can help reduce all forms of disease. Now, also from Science Daily, a good study showing that physical activity increases feelings of excitement and enthusiasm. This is from a very important study. Let me report it. It says, quote, people who are more physically active report greater levels of excitement and enthusiasm than people who are less physically active. This is Penn State research. And, quote, you don't have to be the fittest person who's exercising every day to receive the feel-good benefits of exercise. It's a matter of taking it in one day at a time and trying to become more active. Well, there's a simple reason because, and this was published in Journal of Sports and Exercise Physiology, because you're increasing endorphins. You're increasing the feel-good hormones in your brain when you exercise. So the more exercise, the more that occurs. I found this a good study. It's from University of Bristol School of Sciences, and it says, growing up on a farm directly affects the regulation of your immune system. Now, it's very technical here about what it says about lymphocytes and immune system cells, but what it means is that when you're on a farm and you're out in trees and grasses and in the woods, you're inhaling from an early age, you're inhaling different particulate matter, all of which is stimulating the immune system. You're around animals, that's a stimulating immune system. So quite simply, you have a better immune system growing up on a farm than if you grow up in the city. And that's good news. And finally, herbal treatments prevent balding, stopping hair loss, and regrow hair. And this is from J.B. Bardot of Natural News. It says, quote, many people are deeply concerned about the condition of their hair and will do almost anything to prevent hair loss or to regrow hair. There are a variety of pharmaceutical products that claim to promote hair growth and prevent thinning hair. However, they can cause dangerous side effects and often don't work. Herbal treatments have been used for centuries to treat the scalp and hair, and many are effective in preventing baldness and even restoring hair pigment to its original color. And what are their remedies? Ginkgo biloba. That's right, ginkgo biloba. Why? Because it increases blood flow to the hair follicles in the scalp and strengthening and stimulating the hair shaft. And then polygonum, that's P-O-L-Y, polygonum, G-O-N-U-M, multiflorum, M-U-L-T-I-F-L-O-R-U-M. It's also known, by the way, as Fotai, F-O-T-I. And it's a Chinese herb. It's been used for hundreds of years to help promote new hair growth, restore hair to its original color, and to slow the aging process. And then using aromatherapy mixtures topically on the scalp may help regrow hair in some cases. A mixture of the essential oils, mainly rosemary, cedarwood, lavender, and thyme, can be applied to the scalp to stimulate blood flow and hair growth. And also reishi mushrooms. Reishi is R-E-I-S-H-I, or Ganoderma. It's also known to be very powerful in Chinese medicine for hair growth. So those are some things that can help grow your hair. Let's say hello to Alan from Brooklyn. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
I've been looking at Googling all kinds of things about the Illuminati, and I really, my own thoughts are, I think that the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers are the men behind the curtain. And I saw a movie recently called V for Vendetta, and it seems that it's a very interesting movie that I think a lot of people in this audience should watch, because I think it's a scene. It reminds me of what's going on.
Okay, Alan, let me share a suggestion with you. One of the reasons that so many people who have been on track to find the truth have been discredited, not just for a single point of information, but all the information, is because they have some information that's correct and then they step over that line in speculation. Don't look for an Illuminati. Instead, just look simply at this. I'll show you what we just did, and it didn't take that long. It only took about 2 months, but reverse the process. You end up finding that the people at the 12 Federal Reserve banks, who are they? Who are the top people there? You'll find that, for example, at the New York Bank, the head of it comes from Goldman Sachs. And then find out what other organizations they sit on the board of or have sat on the board of. And then you track it back from there. Who are the largest block of stockholders? Because it's who owns the majority of stock that has control over a company. And then you'll see a clever thing that the wealthiest people who choose to use their wealth for additional power do. They accumulate power without bringing attention to themselves by not having things in their name. So they don't have to have a name Rothschild or Warburg or Schaff or Mellon. Or Rockefeller on or J.P. Morgan on a bank. They don't have to do that anymore. In fact, one major family, the Rothschild family, has, at least that we've been able to track, over 1,300 different businesses, major businesses, that it actually controls. Their name is not on one, but they own the majority of the stock, and they are influential in getting their people on the boards and getting the people from the boards to get the directors and then get their presidents and the CEO and CFO and the people who run a company at their leisure. So all the money finally trickles down to them or up to them. So then you have to do the same thing with, let's say, the Bilderberg Group. Again, keep this notion that this is an Illuminati. It's just a group of people who got together and are encouraging and supportive of one another. And once you're in that circle, whether you come from the news media or maybe the film industry, entertainment industry, or maybe owning a network or an oil company, but all areas are represented. Major players in the pharmaceutical industry and in big agri and energy companies and banking, armaments. These are the individuals at the very top who all meet together and decide policies. So that's what you're dealing with. All right? That's what you're dealing with. So please understand that's where the focus is. Until such time that we can have true, legitimate, third-party people representing the wide interest of all people, then we're never going to pull back the curtain in all this. But within the next 3 weeks, I will post a chart on my website, a scholarly chart that no one will be able to refute. And these are the most powerful people in the world, and these are the companies they control, and all this is based upon legal verification. So then they may not like what you're saying, but they can't discredit it. So yes, it was the bankers, but behind the bankers were individuals. Who are these individuals? How do they do all that they... How come they never get bad press? Because every single network has some individuals from that network who are working with them. Why is it they never get indicted on anything? Because they control every single department that would impact them. So, I'll get into this in greater depth. And I'm going to take another call here in a moment, but I want to mention that Monday night on the Progressive Commentary Hour, We're going to deal with the 12 tipping points. This will be the most comprehensive, in-depth program you will have ever listened to on our environment. For some, it will be scary, because when talking about the tipping points, you will think, well, gee whiz, why didn't I know about that? Why isn't that news? Why aren't we doing something? In some cases, it's too late. In other cases, it's not. Professor Henry Pollack and his colleagues from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who shared the Nobel Prize, will be my guest. He is a professor of geophysics, University of Michigan. Dr. Sylvia Earle, clearly one of America's greatest oceanographers and ocean explorers, will be here. Professor David Montgomery, he is a geomorphologist teaching University of Washington, specializing in evolution of geological topography systems. So you will have a very comprehensive program. You won't want to miss that. And if you missed this past Monday night on the failure of our war on drugs and why we shouldn't even have a war on drugs, you can go to the archives and download those. So we've got a lot coming to you, and I will be at 8 o'clock to our show on Sunday. We're going to finish up here with Suni from New York City. Hi, Suni, your turn.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Noll. May I ask two questions?
Sure.
Yes, okay. The first one is there any truth or science behind the blood type diet? And the other question...
None at all.
No, none at all.
It's completely nonsensical and has been for years. To challenge it, I put almost 30,000 people on the same identical program, and yet we tested, they had all different types of blood types, they all benefited.
Okay, right. And the other one is, when the adrenal are depleted, does it affect the sugar level? A person can develop hypoglycemia from...
Yes, it does, because the adrenal glands need pantothenic acid, they need biotin, they need vitamin C. In fact, you have an enormous amount of vitamin C per percentage of body system in the adrenal cortex. And that's why vitamin C, pantothenic acid, 500 milligrams pantothenic acid, 1,000, 2,000 milligrams a day of vitamin C, and a few micrograms of biotin can make a big difference. Then check your insulin levels and check your cortisol levels. As cortisol goes up, insulin goes up, blood sugar goes up. As you develop fatigue because of overstress or overwork, not getting enough sleep, the adrenals come down, the blood sugar goes down, and you end up with chronic fatigue, or you end up with hypoglycemia. Thank you very much for your call. We're out of time. I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Gary Noll, and today, honoring Black Education Day with my guest who was on earlier, and I want to hope that all of you have a wonderful day. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. ¶¶